Welcome to a smashing new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and I'm here with my two sidekicks, my two riding companions, bounty hunters to the end. We have Danny King, a writer for the Film Stage.
Hello, welcome to our podcast.
And we have Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello, welcome to what is either our last episode of 2012 or our first episode of 2013.
That's true. We are on the bubble, and depending upon me and my ability to fight back jet lag and what basically boils down to a five-day bender that I had in the great state of Texas, this could be out sooner or later. So
yeah, people listening don't know, we is currently 10:54 p.m. on a Sunday
Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah, we are. I'm really in the central time zone, so it's 9:54
okay
for me.
But good, we are going late. It's the latest we've ever been.
That's just how time works. I'm in a different zone.
Right.
Oh, man. It's like a sci-fi thing happening right now. Danny, the future is awesome, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a little colder, but you know what? It's a little happier, too. Anyone who's just joining us, we will have...
This is already our worst episode.
Hey. We don't want to end / begin the year on a down note. So let's think about this in a positive way.
This episode's
going to be awesome. Nick, I'm tired of you.
No.
So anyone who's just joining us for the first time, we will be discussing a new release review. That'll be our feature review. And this week it'll be Django Unchained, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, starring Christoph Waltz and Jamie Foxx, as well as Leonardo DiCaprio, Kerry Washington, and Samuel L. Jackson. Before we get into that, we'll be having a brief movie discussion, and then immediately following the review of Django Unchained, we'll be talking about your best bets for what's coming out on Blu-ray and in theaters in the coming week. And then we'll give you a random recommendation of something we watched on our own. So let's just jump right into it. Nick came up with this week's discussion topic, so let's pass it to him.
It's about race, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
And in no way will anyone be offended.
No. Well, I don't, in all seriousness, I don't think anybody will be offended here. I mean, we're just three white guys talking about race and black animosity. It's, nothing can go wrong here. So would you like me to, get going?
Yeah, kick us off, man.
Start slowing. Well, with the release of Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's slavery Western epic, there's been a bit of controversy. On a small scale, you read a few articles. Many of them are fascinating, where you read about black or white audience members kind of talking about the racial dynamic of the film and how their audiences respond to it based on their own genetic makeup. But on a larger scale, and what we're going to talk about today, but I do think it ties back to that, is filmmaker Spike Lee, who recently has come out with a series of public statements against Django Unchained and its treatment of slavery as a subject. Now, anybody who knows anything about Spike Lee's relationship with Quentin Tarantino will not be surprised. I think anybody who knows anything really about Spike Lee will not be surprised that he's not so enthusiastic about Django Unchained. But in particular, they've had sort of a funny relationship. As you may or may not know, Quentin Tarantino briefly starred in Spike Lee's film Girl 6, which would indicate that things were going okay, but with the release of Jackie Brown, a film centered on a black woman and which features several uses of the N-word, Spike Lee was quite... he had a few problems with that, needless to say. And at the time, he questioned whether or not Tarantino wants to be made an honorary black man. Those were the words he used. And since then, it has sort of thrown an interesting light on Tarantino's treatment of racial dynamics in his films. I mean, the most famous example, of course, is Pulp Fiction, in which his character says a few unkind words. But then you go to Jackie Brown, you have Reservoir Dogs as well, and now Django, which features quite a few uses of that dreaded N-word. And in the recent, I suppose this started about 2 weeks ago, in recent news events, Spike Lee has come out and really come hard against this film. He said that he thinks that it's irresponsible of Tarantino to treat slavery like a spaghetti western or something that's really just anything that's remotely entertaining, because he feels that as a black man who is a descendant of slaves, it's irresponsible and it's tasteless. And this has spurred a conversation. Is it proper for a white man to make a film like this? Is it proper for a black filmmaker to make a response to a film like this that he has not seen? Who's right here? Who's wrong? Is anybody right or wrong?
Danny, why don't you answer?
Well, I'll answer just briefly by mentioning a quick anecdote that I wasn't expecting to bring up, but that seems a little bit relevant now, which was a few weeks ago in one of my classes, one of my teachers screened Beasts of the Southern Wild for us. And
was it Emmanuel Levy?
Yeah, it was actually. And after the screening, there was a lot of discussion about the idea of Ben Zeitlin, this 29-year-old white guy from Brooklyn, making a movie about these black people in this environment that he obviously has very little experience with. And one way or another, we got to talking about Spike Lee. And I think one of the students mentioned a quote of Spike Lee's where it was around the time of Malcolm X, and he said something like, "No white man should ever make a film about Malcolm X." And so when Spike Lee came out with these tweets, you know, I wasn't surprised, obviously, from his relationship with Tarantino over the long period, but also because he's just is a very opinionated stance on this topic. And so I think it's tough kind of to have a conversation with Spike Lee in that respect, because he seems like he's set in his beliefs. He doesn't even want to see the film. And I mean, I don't think I want to argue with him about it just because he seems so set in his ways. And I think he has a right to his opinion. But I think there is a discussion to be had about how race is depicted in the film. And I think it's too aggressive of a film for that conversation not to be heated and very two-sided. So right now, just in terms of who's right and who's wrong, I don't know if anyone's right or wrong, but I would prefer someone to come out and speak who's willing to kind of foster a discussion about it rather than Spike Lee's kind of one-off, just dismissing it.
Which is why we're here.
Yeah.
This is our cultural moment, guys. We're going to start the discussion. Yeah, I don't know. My main problem with that is just this idea that if a person doesn't share a certain background, that they can't create any art that may explore said background. Or, I mean, with writers, my favorite author, Ian McEwan, recently put out a book called Sweet Tooth that is told from a first-person perspective of a female, as was probably his most acclaimed book, Atonement. And a lot of women seem to take exception with that. And I don't quite understand why. And it just seems weird that you would have to say, like, hey, you're a white male or you're a black male or you're an Asian female. Like, you're not allowed to write or make art that expresses a viewpoint outside of your own, like, history. That just doesn't sync up with me. I mean, we have non-astronauts making movies about astronauts. We have people speculating about the future. It just, limiting yourself like that seems like the exact opposite of what any person who is serious about art would really want to do. Because I think that in forcing yourself into the perspective of someone who you're not and really trying to inhabit them, as long as you're doing it in a way that's not trying to belittle them, I mean, that just seems like the type of thing that people would want to happen, because it would foster that kind of discussion and a further understanding. So yeah, I don't get it. I don't quite understand. I mean, we had talked about Spike Lee's tweets in particular. He said, you know, American slavery was not a Sergio Leone Western, spaghetti Western. It was a Holocaust. My ancestors are slaves stolen from Africa. I will honor them. I guess not seeing the movie honors them. I'm not sure what, like, happens after that tweet that's what he's doing. But I mean, you know, the American West wasn't a spaghetti Western. Like, a spaghetti Western isn't a thing that ever really happened. So to put it like that, I don't know. It seems odd to me. And
yeah, I do think that, to his credit, first of all, the reaction to this I've been a little troubled by, because I feel like, let's be frank here, a lot of the reactions are coming from white people. They're the ones who are reacting to the story for the most part. Yes. And I feel like as a white person, it is impossible to grasp the cultural significance that this film may hold for him and the societal significance that it may hold. And it's something that, because, I mean, that's a big condition. And it's something that I don't think people are taking into a full account. And I mean, hey, I'm the biggest Tarantino fan you'll meet. I'm an acolyte. But when I saw this, not for one second did I think, oh, Spike Lee should shut up. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I thought to myself, well, you know, okay, yeah, I could see it.
Yeah, no, I mean, he has an opinion and it's his right to express that. Right. I just think it's odd that, I guess based solely off the trailer or the ideal, the trailer or the idea of it, that he was like writing it out outright.
I do think, but again, there is also, I don't think it's just that, because you think about how he's had a problem with Tarantino for at least 15 years. Yeah. It's actually a similar problem that Denzel Washington has had until, funny enough, his daughter was a production assistant on Django Unchained. He's since patched things up with him, but I remember reading a story, as you may or may not know, Tarantino did some minor rewrites on Crimson Tide.
Yes, he
and
did.
One day he was on the set and he was watching Tony Scott, a friend of his, direct the film. And Washington came up to him and he just outright asked him, so why are you using the N-word in your films? It doesn't seem right that you do that. So clearly this is something that goes past Spike Lee. Granted, Denzel and Spike are close, so perhaps they had a conversation about this at one point, for all we know. But nevertheless, this is something that goes past one person. And on top of that, I think it's important to remember that somebody actually asked Spike Lee about it. He didn't just come out and say this.
Right.
Someone did ask him, so are you going to go see Django Unchained? So, you know, it's not as if he's suddenly going off on a rant like Kevin Smith or somebody just because, you know, he woke up on the wrong side of the bed.
Yeah, no.
I know I just said like 10 things there at once. So.
I was about to say, I'm not sure which one of those to go at first. Is it the use of the word in general? Is it the context of the word? Does anyone know for certain?
I'm pretty well in Pulp Fiction. It is an interesting question because it is actually kind of, I mean, not kind of, it's absolutely used for comedic effect, and it's said by a white man who is played by Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, this is true.
But at the same time, I don't think that it. This actually reminds me of the debate, this idiotic, frustrating, makes you want to pull your hair out debate that's going on around Zero Dark Thirty and the question of torture.
Oh, God.
Because the thing about Zero Dark Thirty is that it does not condone torture at all. And a bunch of harebrained individuals have suddenly decided to take it upon themselves to act like it does because it doesn't conform to their own agenda. And I feel like this is a not entirely similar situation, but it's not that far off. And yet, at the same time, you have to remember that this is an artist who is speaking. And if he's going to depict black characters and he wants to depict them realistically, and especially if he's going to depict slavery and he wants to depict it realistically, you're going to have to go to certain places.
Right.
There's no two ways about it. I mean, do you chastise Steven Spielberg for adapting Alice Walker when he made The Color Purple? And having that kind of material in there? No, I don't think you can. I'm not saying that you have to be okay with it, but I think there's a limit.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically about where I'd fall. I have yet to see Zero Dark Thirty, so I can't really make any comment on the similarities between the two films or the two ideas.
One of the things I almost prefer about Spike Lee's stance versus the people saying that Zero Dark Thirty condones torture is that those Zero Dark Thirty people have written kind of like full length essays trying to sort of intellectualize their opinion without having seen the film, while Spike Lee is just kind of coming out and making it clear that it's just a really emotional, personal topic for him, which is pretty acceptable.
Right. I don't mean to compare them completely. I think there are similarities.
Yeah, no, I think there are. I was just pointing out a difference. I think you're
100% correct. It is. And also, I mean, the people who are doing the torture thing with Zero Dark Thirty are a bunch of dipshits. So that too, that matters as well.
Okay.
No, I'm serious though. You look at the people and it's, I won't name names, but you know who I'm talking about.
Okay. We're going to talk about this more off the record.
All right.
Again, I unfortunately have yet to see Zero Dark Thirty, so I can't really weigh in. But I mean, if we're gonna get into movies being misrepresented by certain people, I mean, we did torture people, guys. That is a thing that happened, and
you know, the N-word was said.
Yeah, and the N-word was said. I mean, I just don't. It's weird that you'd want to censor it in a way just to like try to make yourself feel better. I don't get it. I don't get what removing that.
I don't think this is a question of censoring. I think it's a question of portrayal, because he mentions, of course, Sergio Leone in conjunction with Django and the issue of slavery.
Right.
And it's also about who is doing the portrayal too. I got to be careful here. Would Spike Lee have as much of a problem if a black man Django Unchained? I'm going to say no. Or rather, if it was not Quentin Tarantino specifically.
That is also probably true.
But again, we have to emphasize this enough. Speaking as whites, as we are, as Caucasians, we don't have that perspective. And it's because of that, I really have no problem with what Spike Lee is saying, ultimately. I understand, even if I think he should see the movie to make a comment of this sort. You know, I am sort of at a disadvantage at the same time.
All right. Well, that's... I don't believe I have anything else to add to this conversation. Do we have any final thoughts before we move on into the actual review of the film, which we have been vaguely, obliquely talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like a lot of this stuff will probably come back up in the review. So,
all right, excellent. Well, then let's get into it. Now is the time that we will talk about the newest film by writer-director Quentin Tarantino, Django Unchained, as I said, starring Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kerry Washington, and Samuel L. Jackson.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.
Good cold evening, gentlemen. Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe is a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
When I hear the trumpet sound,
what's your name?
I'm on a rise right out of the ground.
Django. Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, stop talking to him.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
So Django Unchained is the story of a slave named Django who is brought out of slavery by a bounty hunter named, ironically, Dr. King Schultz, played by Christoph Waltz, a German man. And after they become kind of partners in taking down a trio of slave enforcers, they decide to find and rescue Django's wife, who was sold into slavery at the plantation of the diabolical, demonic Calvin Candy, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. This is Quentin Tarantino's follow-up to Inglourious Basterds, which we all know won a lot of praise, and kind of almost set a new standard, I think, in terms of people thinking about Quentin Tarantino as a director. So let's see how the follow-up went. Danny, why don't you kick us off with your thoughts on Django Unchained, and spoiler-free, and then we'll get into spoilers later.
I really liked Django Unchained. I thought it was a pretty great piece of entertainment. I'm having a little bit of trouble putting my finger on just how much I liked it, because I think there are a lot of ways where it could have been better. I remember that I read the script probably about a year ago. So when I went in to finally see the film, I didn't remember a lot of specifics. But I remember kind of thinking from the script that the film was a similar tonally to Inglourious Basterds in terms of kind of attacking these historical moments. And one of the things that's a little bit different about Django Unchained to me was that you have a very clear sort of main character with one goal. It's sort of a revenge story about Jamie Foxx trying to get his wife back. And what that does is it kind of limits the size of the ensemble to me. So one of the things that was a little bit of a drawback for me was maybe outside of like three or four main characters, I didn't really get the richness of the ensemble that Inglourious Basterds had, because Jamie Foxx is always kind of either on screen or involved with the scene at hand. So it kind of keeps it very driven. But I mean, on the other hand, that gives the film more of kind of a through line emotionally. And so it's perhaps more satisfying in that sense. one of the things that I think Django Unchained does maybe more ambitiously is I think it's a lot darker in terms of how it presents its historical focus. And that's a little bit of what we were talking about earlier. But, you know, a lot of the things I've read about Leonardo DiCaprio's performance is that he's kind of like having fun or he's letting loose. But to me, it's a really vile character that's sort of, if you just say he's having fun, it's not really doing justice to sort of how dark he is and how dark the film gets at certain points. So I think what stuck with me the most is kind of how far it did delve into kind of the atrocities of slavery. And so those are some of my early thoughts.
And Nick, what about yourself?
I loved Django Unchained, and I have seen the film twice now, hoping to see it at least one more time before it leaves theaters, which, considering the business it's doing, I'm sure I'll have the chance to at some point. And I think that for myself, as I said before, I'm a massive Quentin Tarantino fan, and so with every new film he makes, I always have to weigh it on two scales. One is how I feel about it just as a film, but then there's also the consideration of how it fits into his career as an auteur. And I think that Django Unchained is probably one of the more fascinating films he's ever made, both because of the way it complements, comments upon, and reflects Inglourious Basterds, and also how I think it's up to something that's even stranger and even more ambitious than a lot of people are completely grasping. And so that's one thing, but then there's also just the experience of watching the film itself, which is, I mean, a great time. It's, how long is this film? About 165 minutes. And even though it is long, even though it's perhaps a bit too long, I think that it is so perfectly, it's such a perfect evocation of this era and sort of the mindset that the main character is going through. So this very driven revenge story that it's a complete pleasure to just watch and bask in as an experience on top of simply a motion picture.
Yeah, I love this film. I'll say that. I don't know, man. Like we've watched a lot of long movies this year. Movies lengths have been creeping ever upward, and I've really felt it sometimes. I think everyone who listens to this regularly can guess some of the films that I might be talking about. And so what a relief it was to step out of the theater after having seen this and to have had my first impulse be to immediately cancel my plans for the day and go back in and see it again. It's, I don't know, man. It's hard to say that it's a fun movie because it does drag up a lot of very dark, touchy things that are, you know, you can't really revel in them, but it's done with such energy and the actors and the writing is just so on point. And I don't like the gore and like every aspect of it. It never lets you forget the fact that this is a terrible, awful thing that's happening, but it also doesn't forget the fact that it's a movie that's supposed to give you some kind of uplift. You know, it's not a dreary, drab, like, march through a sordid history of all of the crimes done against African Americans in our history. It actually does act through that revenge plotline as a kind of catharsis. I don't know if that's the right word, but I mean, I can't think of a film that I had more fun at, and like, I was in a theater just packed with people, and there was just raucous applause and laughter. And it was the kind of movie where at some point when Django's about to get his kill on, someone next to me screamed out just Django. And instead of everyone being pissed off, we all just like applauded and cheered. Like that kind of movie, you know, the kind that really gets you into the movies. And it, I don't know, man, it was so refreshing after like the slog that The Hobbit was and just a lot of the other films that we've had to watch. And it's great. Like I loved it. I loved every second of it. I downloaded the music. This is apparently the year of movie music for me. And yeah, I can't think of anything really negative to say about it. Like I've been telling people that I don't even know just on the street, like, yeah, Django Unchained, see it. It's the best. Like, I don't know. It's hard to say more than that.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more about the pacing. I've read quite a few reviews, even positive ones, that have said they thought the film was too long, or that I've read a surprising amount of reviews where people say the pacing slows down when the film goes to Candyland, which is the plantation owned by Leonardo DiCaprio's character. And to me, it was like, if anything, I wanted even more time there, just because it's so well done. And the movie, I don't know if the pacing is even throughout, but on the whole, if you compare it to things like what you mentioned, like The Hobbit or even Les Mis, it totally flies by.
Yeah, it's,
yeah, I do think it is a very well structured movie, but I do have some problems with the pacing. I think that when you, there's sort of this weird interim period between when Leonardo DiCaprio is introduced and sort of when the main action of Candyland begins, when I feel like it's a little odd, perhaps, the way you have the reunion between Django and Broomhilda is sort of, it feels a little wedged in, I think, into the action. And it's a brief thing. Like, it's not a huge complaint, but I do think that perhaps those 10 or 15 minutes just don't quite flow at the same pace, because I do think that the movie has, you said the pacing isn't necessarily even, and I do agree. I think the movie is very deliberate in slowing down once you get to Candyland, but there is sort of a weird transition period there that both times has bothered me a little bit.
I guess I can see that, but I don't know. Like, I just, it was so engrossing. Like, I could feel a different, I could feel the shift, you know, the gears ground a little bit. Maybe it wasn't done as fluidly as it could have been. But I mean, it, when it catches again, it catches so well that it's almost like, you know, you have that one little jerk and then you just forget about it because you're back on the speedway. Like, I've become so used to talking about movies that I dislike that now that I've come across one that I do like, I'm just kind of like stopped up. And it's just like, no, it's just good. Yeah. I mean, like the weird humor, the Tarantino-esque humor that gets injected, and just the character of Dr. King Schultz. I mean, like, from the opening when he first arrives, you can see the scene in the trailer upon the chain of slaves that are being driven, and just like every moment with him in it is just a joy. Mm-hmm. And Jamie
Foxx, his horse Fritz,
who, like, I went and saw this with my brother, and when the horse did its little bow, we both kind of thought that it was just a fortuitous thing that happened, but then like it started happening again and I was like, holy shit, the horse totally like does a curtsy every time that they say its name, like things like
that.
And
the tooth on top of the wagon,
the giant wobbling tooth,
that was amazing.
What kind of doctor are you?
I was obsessed with that tooth. I was like, could you get something like that back in those days? Like, is that something that you could actually acquire? It was crazy. I don't know why the tooth affected me so, but I mean, just, and then the friendship between Django and Schultz, it just, like, you know, we'd already said, you know, it's not as much of an ensemble piece as some of Tarantino's other films, and it's a lot more linear too.
I mean, probably the most linear movies ever made.
Yeah, I mean, and it was weird, but you know, it made sense and it worked for me, and it was interesting to watch, and I loved being able to chart the affections rising between these two people, and to actually see that. I mean, we can get into it in spoilers, but just the way that they both kind of play out their roles towards the end, it was incredible, and it was nuanced, and it was, I don't know, it was just good. It was a propulsive, you know, grab you and don't let go type of thing, if I want to use some like hacky Pete Hammond talk.
Did it sneak up and floor you?
It didn't sneak up and floor me, because there's no way this movie could sneak up on anyone. This is like that's a true car that's powered by just constant explosions that just move it forward. It's a good time at the movies, and it, I don't know.
So two things. The first of these is shorter. I think that it's worth discussing how much humanism and warmth there is in this movie. A really surprising amount. And I think that it's been amazing to see how Tarantino has gone from someone who I don't think had a lot of heart in his earlier films, with the few exceptions. I mean, Jackie Brown, of course, has a great love story at it, and Pulp Fiction has scenes of that. But for the most part, his movies didn't really contain that, but I think that starting with Kill Bill, he became a really warm filmmaker, which is weird to say about somebody who makes a film where when someone gets shot, it is the bloodiest gunshot in film history every single time.
An extra 7 pints of blood in the human head, just to really drive the point home.
Right. But at the same time, there's not only this very real love story at the center of it, but there's also a genuine affection between Dr. King Schultz and Django.
Right.
That really took me aback both times. I was shocked at how much you could tell Schultz really cares for Django. And I think it's what drives the movie. And
It definitely is. And that actually surprised me a lot, because I was watching it and I was just surprised at how much of the emotional, like, more grounded, nuanced, you know, not just trying to save the wife and, you know, get your freedom, but just watching Schultz kind of become more intrigued and then interested in Django and the way that that affects him and, like, drives his judgment. It was incredibly sneaky. Maybe that's the part that snuck up and floored me, if there has to be a part like that. But yeah, I mean, when we get into spoilers, we could talk about it. Because there's a point at the movie when I sat back and realized, like, holy shit, this is what's happening and this is what's going to happen. And it was great.
And second thing, it's what I said before. I think that there's a lot going on under the surface of this movie. And I think that one of the most important things to discuss is the way that it's a critique of capitalism, which really surprised me when I saw the film. I was not expecting him to sort of take on this new subject, and especially in the way he did, but it's a pretty bracing laceration of... Wait, is that bracing laceration? Does that make sense?
That's a term, yeah.
Really? Okay. I thought it was, but I was thinking about
something. It's a laceration that makes you brace. Yeah.
Yes. No. But there's a really bracing laceration of the business mindset in this movie. And I think that it is definitely part of what makes it a connecting piece to Inglourious Basterds is the way that he's moving on to this new facet of not just human history, but what was driving that human history as well. And I think that, to me, this is a movie that is not necessarily... I think that this is a film that is almost using the exploitation techniques to try and cover up the awfulness of this period of history. But it's a movie that's constantly being interrupted by and punctuated by just how terrible this time really was. And I think that one of the moments that has stuck with me the most is a scene toward the end. This is not a spoiler, but there's a scene toward the end of the movie where Christoph Waltz's character is sitting in a chair and he's listening to someone play Beethoven on a harp. And suddenly the moment is interrupted by the memory of this man who was eaten alive by dogs that were ordered on him by Leonardo DiCaprio's character. And I think that there's something about it that has really troubled me, and in a good way, because I think that what he's doing here is he's showing how you've come to really enjoy watching the Leonardo DiCaprio character, and you've come to want more and more of him on screen as it goes along, but then he brings it back, and you realize that, no, this is very bad what you were watching. It's bad that you are actually enjoying being in this man's company, because you realize the things that he's not only capable of, but the things that he's fully willing to do.
Right.
And that, to me, is very emblematic of the film itself, where you're watching it and you're being entertained by it. But this actually kind of goes back to the thing about Spike Lee, is why he should probably see the movie, is because even though you were entertained by it, there is there's a weird level of guilt, I think, that he's putting on the audience as they're watching it. The fact that they are relishing in this sort of time period when, in fact, he shows over and over that it was really horrible. And the way he's able to manipulate that, I think it completely subverts what people are expecting of him. I think it completely subverts what people are saying about the film. A lot of people are going on about how, well, you know, he's using the Sergio Leone-esque, Sergio Corbucci-esque ideas to make this piece of entertainment, when in fact, I think what he's really doing is that he's taking these ideas and he's commenting upon the entire genre and criticizing it in a way. I think that this is a retroactive form of criticism in the way that they looked at these times, but they didn't really address how awful they could truly be. And he's almost recreating one of these films, and then he's interrupting it. He's sort of doing a record scratch by showing, well, no, they would have people beaten alive by dogs. Well, no, they were chained up and they had to walk 37 miles. And, you know, you see what happens to their feet, for example.
Right.
And that to me is what makes this not just an important work in his career, but also an important work in general.
All right. I think that is an excellent opportunity for us to go into spoilers, because I think to talk about that and to tie it back in with what we were saying about some of the warm character work done, we have to start talking about the way in which this movie ends. Everyone in agreement?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, to the spoilers. Yeah, I mean, you brought up the scene, Nick. They make a complicated plan to try to get Broomhilda back from Calvin Candy, a plan that would have worked were it not for the house servant played by Samuel L. Jackson in a bafflingly effective role. I mean, the relationship between Samuel L. Jackson's character, whose name is Steven, and Calvin Candy, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, is like fodder for a whole movie in and of itself. And I like that we're not given too much of it, because I think that the shading that they give is more than enough. And, you know, I don't want to have my hand held too much in a film. So I liked it a lot. But, yeah, Steven figures out what's going on, tips off Leonardo DiCaprio's character, and shit gets real. And this is the point, really, where Leonardo DiCaprio's little affectations and all of his kind of almost Bond villain-esque posturing really turns sour in your mouth. Like, you've been enjoying watching this guy. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio has been in some movies where he's not the greatest guy, but I don't think we've ever seen him become as just horribly, decrepitly dark in the soul as he does here. And so that, like,
my moment, dead wife.
What?
In what? Well, it kind of became a thing for a while where Leonardo DiCaprio, his characters would always have a dead wife. You know, in 2010, there was Shutter Island and Inception, which are basically the analog and digital versions of the same story.
Okay.
And, you know,
Shutter Island's
my
better.
Dead wife.
Okay. Yeah, no, I guess I can see that. Yeah, there is no dead wife to make you feel better about Leonardo DiCaprio's character. And so,
no, he just has a beautiful sister.
Yeah, he was really into his sister.
Yeah, that was, I don't know what was, that's an element I'm glad Tarantino didn't go into more.
Yeah, no, because it was just kind of a weird, like I said, a weird affectation. And if he had pushed it too far into the obvious, like, Southern people have sex with their sisters type of thing, I think that would have just been too much. But I mean, as it was, anyway, we could talk an entire podcast, I think, for each of these characters. Which would be fun for anyone who has the time to do that. Unfortunately, we do not. But yes, so it comes out that they really want Broomhilda. Leonardo DiCaprio turns the tables on them, but he is willing to sell her for $12,000, which they have in cash. So they make the deal, and they're ready to just walk out. Christoph Waltz is listening to the person playing the harp. And he, like you said, there's that scene where it just keeps cutting back really jarringly and like viscerally to that scene that you saw earlier that, you know, was there to, you know, not only give you an idea of how like awful Leonardo DiCaprio is, but also to reinforce some ideas about Django and his willingness to be with his wife and the things that he was willing to put on the block in order to get back with her. And the scene that I was talking about earlier when I said it kind of tipped me off to where the movie was going was just the watching Schultz stand up and say that he would pay to like save this poor slave who has been just completely wrecked by this Mandingo fighting that Calvin Candy engages in.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did that, and when Django had to cover for him saying that it was boredom and not compassion that was making him say that, it really brought home the evolution that Schultz had gone through. Because at first he was just kind of like, I don't really care. You know, I'm trying to make my money and get my living. And I'm not a fan of slavery, obviously, but I'll use it to my advantage in this case. And when I saw him stand up and do that, and I saw his growing distaste for Calvin Candy, I just kind of knew that this was coming. This moment where his humanism would break and he would end up doing something rash. And so when he's willing to walk out, I was really happy that it went down that way. But then Calvin Candy, the magnificent piece of shit, son of a bitch that he is, he demands a handshake. He demands a show of respect, even though Schultz has nothing but the utmost contempt for him and people like him. and then Schultz shoots him down. And it's one of those scenes where, you know, it's just kind of cool to finally see the bad guy get got, to use some Wire phrasing, if anyone's a fan of that show.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's great to see Candy get got. But at the same time, it's one of the most conflicting moments that I've had in a movie, because as much as I'm like, yes, finally someone has put a bullet in that guy, you know that no good will come of it, that this like mad, like earnest emotional retribution is only going to lead to more crap. And that's a really heady idea that's like not really put forward in a lot of films. And I liked that because it gives you what you really want, which is just to see someone take Leonardo DiCaprio out. But then it puts you in that second mindset where it's just like, well, now there's nothing left. Like, it's just guns blazing, epic, endless violence of the most bloody kind. And in the end, it brings them right back to square one. Django's back in chains. He's getting sent off to some mines. And his wife is still in slavery.
But it really doesn't bring them back to square one.
No, it doesn't, because obviously things have changed. I mean,
I'm saying that because I've seen some criticism about the fact that the movie is seemingly 20 minutes longer than it should be, but
right,
I do think that
this scene,
the last 20 minutes are in fact the most important to Django as a character.
Oh yes,
because
no, I definitely
we've
agree.
Talked about, I mean, I mentioned before how the film deals with the horrors of business, and I think that that is the moment when Django finally truly becomes a character of his own agency, and when he is at once enacting what has been taught to him by Dr. King Schultz.
Right. And that's I loved that about that scene. I don't want to make it seem as though I'm like...
Right.
It's the same problem I had when people said that The Dark Knight Rises was stupid because it had two risings. And I'm like, if you really think that the first one was the climax that you should have been waiting for, then you don't understand what the movie is saying. So I'm on board with you when people say that the movie goes 20 minutes too long because of the scene where, you know, Django's back in chains and has to come back and basically reenact the first climax all over again. Like, I don't get that. That doesn't make any sense to me. That's obviously not the way that it plays out thematically.
No, exactly. I think that the movie would completely fall under its own weight if you just had it end with him killing everybody in Candyland there. Granted, I mean, well, no, I shouldn't say that. It wouldn't fall under its own weight. It'd be a very satisfying moment, but I don't think that thematically it would have nearly as much of a through line if you did not carry that out and see how he can learn more than just killing, because the film itself is about more than just killing.
Yes, it is.
And I think that if it had ended there, then the movie would probably be only about 3/4 complete as is. So, yeah, just saying that.
No, like I said, I totally agree. And yeah, it was just really weird how affected I was at the end of that, at the end of all of this. Like, I wasn't expecting that. And it was really heartening to see that kind of shift and that growth in Tarantino as a director. Because I wasn't expecting Schultz to be more than like the badass who trains Django. And it was weird to see that he was the one who broke, the one who allowed his emotional response to the situation to get the better of him. Because when you think about it, his action, he couldn't have thought that there was a probable good outcome. Like, there were people literally holding guns to everyone in the room.
He just couldn't resist.
He couldn't resist. And who could blame him? And it kind of, like I said, it puts you in that mindset. And yeah, I think it's the scene that, for me, like, made the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was...
you have to love that gun, too.
That little gun. That little, like, it's, like, mounted on the slide, like, taxi driver, but it's just a tiny little Derringer.
Yeah.
It's a cute gun. And just the fact that it like perfectly perforates the center of the corsage. Oh man, so good. Guys, this movie's incredible. And it's one of those things where, I don't know, people kept saying it was too long, but I would be totally fine if they had added more and then split this movie in half, like Kill Bill style. Like, that's
well,
the kind
it's
of...
It's funny you say that, because when I attended the press conference for the film, when I was there, Quentin Tarantino told a story about how Harvey Weinstein suggested that they make it into a two-part film a la Kill Bill, but he said that this needs to be a single film, and he feels that audiences are owed the satisfaction of seeing Django rescue his wife right there.
Yeah.
I think part of that also comes with the fact that he was not at all enthusiastic about splitting Kill Bill into two.
Yeah, no, no. And I get that. And that's why I would also have been down for like a 4-hour cut of this.
Well, I just love it. Just about a month ago, the movie was 192 minutes. And he had to cut stuff out because it was just going too long. And he talked about how he could see himself, I guess, maybe when it's time for a Blu-ray or a little bit after, releasing an extended cut of the movie.
And I would be there. Because unlike The Hobbit or things like that, like this, none of it felt like filler. Like every moment spoke something about the characters and it all seemed to be moving towards something. Like, guys, this is a story that deserves to have this amount of length. Like, they're not, it seemed like they weren't trying to make it this long. It just needed to be this long. And I miss that. And I love that it's back in at least this form.
Right. But also, I also think that there is something very, I don't know, someone, Ethan Vespi, who has been a guest on the show in the past, brought up, he was a little troubled by sort of the question of what Tarantino might be saying about other slaves and sort of how they're supposed to take agency for themselves. And I was considering that, and seeing the movie again, I was thinking that there's something sort of on the periphery of the story that is happening here, where in fact, I think that the movie almost suggests that there is a bit of revisionist history going on here, because you see something like the card of three slaves toward the end that he frees from the Australians. One of whom, did you notice that Quentin Tarantino played one of the Australians? You might not have noticed.
I did. Him.
Yeah.
How would you not notice that?
You didn't notice that, really. You didn't
notice
that.
No, it was weird. Notice, yeah. I noticed it was him. I'm surprised that people would not notice that it was him.
The guy with the massive chin and okay, here's the thing. This is a digression, but I did not know he was supposed to be Australian until the other people started speaking. I thought he was doing some weird southern accent or something.
I think I had that. I think I did need the context of other people speaking Australian accents.
Yeah, because, man, that cameo. I do think there actually is an excuse for that, but I'm kind of saving it for something that I'm currently writing at the moment.
Oh, boo.
So, sorry.
Boo.
But I do think there's a reason for it. Nevertheless, it did get a big laugh in the theater when he just shows up. Like, the first shot, it's him riding there with this stupid grimace on his face. And it's it's interesting. I'll put it that way. It's a very interesting decision on his part to put himself in that scene and then, you know, talk. Aye, shut up, mate. Actually, that's a better Australian accent than he was giving.
I think that's the best impression you've ever done, and it's not a good impression of him. It's just a good impression of an Australian.
Right. Anyway, that was way too long to try to get to what I was discussing. So you see those three slaves in the cart, and there's sort of that knowing smile on one of the slaves' face, almost as if they realize that they can take power for themselves and can take agency. And then you also have at the beginning, you have the row of, I believe it's five other slaves who are given a gun and they're able to march toward freedom.
Yeah.
They kill their master. And then you have at the end the explosion of the plantation on which other slaves live. And I think that unlike Inglourious Basterds, which is much more explicit in its style of revisionist history, where World War II ends because of what happened in Operation Kino, I think that here he's sort of hinting that because of these actions, history will change through cinema. It's just in a more, it's not necessarily as explicit as it was in Bastards. And I don't know if anybody else agrees with that or.
Danny, you've been.
Well, to me, Django's relationship to the other slaves was always kind of a really interesting aspect of the movie. But like you said, it's so sidelined compared to some of the revisionist stuff that's going on in Inglourious Bastards that I almost didn't kind of have enough time to interpret it while I was watching the movie, because it is this really interesting dynamic where he has to kind of like act, you know, like he doesn't respect them, but
yeah,
then
he has to be a black slaver.
Yeah. And then even like you said, in that opening scene where the other slaves are challenged to kind of embrace their freedom and sort of become their own Djangos in a way, it's definitely something that's worthy of consideration. I just don't know if one viewing is enough just because it is more subtle.
No, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't something that I had completely considered the first time out, but the second time with that question on my mind, I was looking for it. And one thing that I'm going back to, which I think supports the idea, is when Glorious Bastards came out, an interviewer asked Tarantino, why is it that in this instance you can have World War II end this way where Hitler is killed in such a fashion? And I think he gave a perfect answer. He said, in real life, these characters didn't exist, so this thing never happened. In my movie, these characters exist, so this sort of thing could happen. And I think that's very true of Django as well.
Oh, yeah.
I think that what's happening here is sort of almost a grassroots movement, which I feel a little funny saying when it comes to something this serious. And when it's also portrayed, you know, in a fictional manner. But I think that there is that revolutionary spark in the film. It's just not necessarily as explicit because it's one man's journey. But I think it's also about the actions that he's carrying out along the way.
Yeah. So. I can't think of anything wrong with that. This is crazy. I can't argue with Nick. I mean, I'm having a weird moment here because I can't argue with you.
Oh,
I don't really know how to respond to that.
Something you're not used to.
No, it's very weird. So yeah, I don't know. I don't believe I have anything else to add.
Right, I might sound like I'm reading too much into the movie, but
no, I don't think you are at all. I'm totally on your level with everything that you're saying.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, people may claim that just because of the style that, you know, it's not meant to be that read into, but I mean, come on, guys. Like,
well,
just because it's in this style.
That's going on, and it's very troubling. I've seen a lot of smart critics who are not really engaging with the movie. They're just looking at it as this fun shoot 'em up time. But I think that.
But it's like it is a rebuke of that idea because it's a fun shoot 'em up time about it's about slavery. It's about this awful moment in our history that people kind of, if you're going to talk about it, it's always on the periphery or in a political sense, and it's not really, you know, down and dirty and showing you all this awful shit that happened.
Yeah, and I do stand by what I said. The movie is really entertaining, but at the same time, I think that a lot of people are only, and I'm so sorry that I'm doing this. I hate doing this. I hate it when people do this, but I'm going to have to do it right here. I think that a lot of people are looking at the movie as the film that Django Unchained is sort of criticizing at the same time. Yes. I think you're only considering that you can enjoy that, you're supposed to enjoy that, and I did. But there is something else going on there. And it is those moments, like the man being torn up by dogs, or the scene where you see Broomhilda being whipped, which is really horrific. And it is the first moment in the movie where suddenly it's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
It becomes very, very serious. And it's a very upsetting scene.
And that's true of a lot of the movie, because this movie whiplashes back and forth between fun and like horrifying.
But the thing is that it's incredible how effective it is when he places that directly before Django commits his first real act of violence in the movie against the three brittle brothers.
Yeah.
It puts it under this whole different context. And to me, it is very much in the spirit of the end of Inglourious Basterds.
And actually, there's a money shot in the trailer where he says, "I like the way you die, boy."
Mm-hmm.
And in the trailer, you know, it kind of lands with kind of like a funny, you know, reversal of the roles and type thing. But like when you put it in the film after that scene that gives you his history with these people, it becomes a lot more than that. And I feel like a lot of the movies like that, like if you want to read it on just the level of this is a fun, violent movie, yeah, that'll work and you'll still get something out of it. But if you really take the time to look at everything that's been put in front of you and put the pieces together, like a line like that, that could just be like a hell yeah, Django, turns into a really invested, deep character moment. And I think that's basically true for everything in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I already mentioned this a little bit, but another sign, obvious sign for me of how serious this movie was just the DiCaprio character, because when I think back on Inglourious Basterds and the character Christoph Waltz played there, I laughed at that guy like a lot, and I was so surprised how little I actually laughed at Calvin Candy in this movie. I mean, like the first thing we see him doing is, if I recall correctly, the first scene we see him in is watching two black guys fight like to near death. And, you know, he's like
to death.
Yeah. And, you know, that scene presides over every subsequent scene that Calvin Candy's in.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, I maybe only laughed at the guy like once or twice. He was just like this depraved, sick figure. that I think is darker than Hans Landa in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think I'll just point out, because I don't know if everyone knows this, apparently there is no like historical backup to the idea that there were these Mandingo fights.
I believe he's taking it from a film title.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, there's a film title Mandingo. I know that, but I believe that's directly
where he's quoting from. But there's, you know, in a film like this where you see these awful things that were happening, like there is a tendency to wonder how much of it is true. And there is a kind of like cultural myth that things like this happened. But yeah, I couldn't find any actual evidence of it. And Slate.com did a post where they actually talked to historians on the subject of slavery. And apparently there's never been any actual backup to that idea. So if anyone was wondering, no.
Right. I forgot who it was, but around they must have seen Django Unchained, because right around the time screenings were starting up, they tweeted, the cleaning woman saw me watching Mandingo, so now she pretty much thinks I'm the worst person ever. Now I'm curious to see the film Mandingo.
Yeah, part of me.
I did some reading on it. Apparently the movie is like really racist.
Yeah, I my first exposure to this movie Mandingo was actually in the television show Archer. And none of you watch Archer, right? We've been through this before.
Yeah, I've seen like one or two episodes.
Okay, yeah. Because Mrs. Archer, who is the head of a spy agency, apparently wanted to write a sequel to Mandingo. And it was referenced as being even more racist. Which was it's a really smart show. You guys should watch it. I think you'd dig it. Because there's a lot of cultural references and like deep strange illusions, and that was one of them. So for some reason throughout this entire movie, every time they talked about it, I just saw this like bitter old 75-year-old woman writing this movie in her head. But yeah, I think we've probably come to the end. Were there any final thoughts that we want to lay out on this? I know we could talk forever, but we're stretching close to the hour mark already. See it. That's all I'm gonna say.
Sure. Yeah, I do feel bad because I have started writing something. I'm like maybe 800 words into it about sort of the extra subtextual elements of Django Unchained, which hopefully will be going up on the sites within a week. I guess I have to actually finish it first.
Well, that's most important. Obviously.
But
have to look for that since you're holding out on us.
I am holding it back a bit because I have a theory on the film that I think after seeing it again, I believe is pretty much airtight.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading that, man.
So, yeah.
Because, you know, you wouldn't want to talk about that on the thing where we're supposed to discuss our feelings about the movie.
You know, it's cool. The episode would just go on longer.
Yes, so. It's true. And we should move on. So, Danny, any final thoughts before we get into the week ahead?
Happy New Year.
All right. So, coming out onto Blu-ray.
just moving on from that nice statement into business.
I was about to say we're not done yet, so I feel like you're gonna have to say that again.
That's why it was really awkward.
Cut that out.
Nope, I'm staying in. Moving on. DVD and Blu-ray.
End of the episode.
Wait, what?
I was saying put it at the end of the episode or something.
Oh man. Third time's a charm. DVD and Blu-ray. So coming out December 31st, which is actually Monday, we have Looper. Which is the movie starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis, directed by Rian Johnson, about the assassins who kill people from the future and then kill themselves. Justified, the complete...
That sounds so much more depressing. Like, it's about assassins who kill people and then they commit suicide. Like, they shoot themselves in the head or they hang themselves or take too many sleeping pills.
Well, I mean, you know, technically they're shooting them.
Right, but I guess the way you phrase
the way you phrase yeah
it sounds like they're in such emotional anguish over killing people that they
yeah no and they're themselves. Actually they're pretty psyched about killing themselves, so I don't know, it's a good movie. I can't wait to own it, so that's definitely
it's a lot of fun.
And Justified season 3 is coming out, which is also great. And apparently there's a Blu-ray double feature of Javier Bardem which involves Beautiful and No Country for Old Men. Also Penguin Drum? I don't know what that is, but it looks awful. So,
I guess it was on the 28th, so it was released on a Friday. The Room came out on Blu-ray.
Oh, I have not seen that yet.
Yeah, I've still never seen that one.
Really?
Yeah.
It is essential viewing.
Okay. We'll have to... We should do a thing on it on a slow weekend.
There are also some releases for January 1st. Unfortunately, the Blu-ray.com slate is so screwed up. For some reason, they're listing the 1974 adaptation of The Great Gatsby, as well as Mean Girls, Paycheck.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like,
they're just listing films at random, it would appear.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't really feeling it, but like bringing them up because.
What about the Javier Bardem double feature?
I talked about that, Danny.
I know, but like we should recommend it.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you want to recommend it,
push that.
Anyway,
pretty good movies.
Yes, so, they are. Yes, I also wanted to mention one of my very favorite films of the year, Cosmopolis, which I know the both of you also loved.
Yeah,
that was coming out on Blu-ray. So I'm gonna just put that on a loop in my house.
Looper.
Oh,
Jesus! Coming to theaters this Friday, January 4th. Two first-class movies. Perfect way to start up the new year. Texas Chainsaw 3D and A Dark Truth.
What is A Dark Truth?
Right?
I have literally no idea.
Andy Garcia and Forest Whitaker star.
That's totally something I would see.
In a movie about a former CIA operative turned political talk show host who is hired by a corporate whistleblower to expose her company's cover-up of a massacre in a South American village.
Oh, God.
No idea. Oh, apparently Eva Longoria is in this as well.
That is going to be so awful.
Yeah, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that I won't see any of these.
I think John Dies at the End is on VOD. I might check that out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's a good one. I do want to see that because I love the author, cracked.com. Great place. He writes there all the time. So,
okay.
Yeah.
We're coming into January, which is
the doldrums.
This is actually a better than normal January, I would say. Granted, I don't think there's going to be something on the level of like Haywire, for instance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're a regular plebe like myself, you still haven't seen Zero Dark Thirty, which comes out the 11th.
Right. I mean, you're living in the middle of nowhere. It's not Los Angeles. Right. What are you doing?
DC is a boondocks, basically, right?
Actually, I didn't consider Zero Dark Thirty because I. You know, excuse me, I saw it like a month ago.
Oh, excuse me.
Sorry. Anyway.
I'm the host of this
January
podcast.
There's Gangster Squad, which might be okay.
I'm looking forward to that a little bit.
There's Broken City, which a friend of the show, Jeremy Smith, pointed out has 21 producers.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Which is a very bad sign. And there's also, I won't go into it too much, but I think this month will be... It'll be tolerable, at least.
I'm looking forward to Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
No, you're not.
Really?
No, I'm not. I'm joking. Parker is also... Look, we're really getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
These are all coming out later. We can talk about them and make fun of them as they come up.
I think for the month of January, we should skip over some of these movies and just watch, you know...
Amour would be great to talk about.
Watch a classic.
Yeah. We'll figure something out. I know we're going to be doing a top 10 episode soon, and we'll probably try to talk about Les Mis and Amour. So look for those, because January is going to be weird, guys. Not going to lie. It's going to be weird. We'll also be talking about Zero Dark Thirty. We'll figure it out. That brings us to the final moments of our podcast when we talk about the movies that we've seen on our own this week. So, Nick, why don't you give us your quick rundown of what you saw and why we should check it out?
Okay. So my semester has finally ended, as is the case with Danny, so I'm sure that we're both watching more movies than, we have been as of late, which is good, right? Am I correct?
Yeah, definitely. I'm probably, that's like all I'm doing.
Oh, cool.
Just watching movies.
So, yeah, I think I am going to recommend Duck Soup, the Marx Brothers film from 1933, directed by Leo McCarey, which I had never seen before. I don't know how that happened, but... last night I was on my Xbox on Netflix Watch Instantly trying to find something. I see this and I figured to myself, sure, why not? And I don't know anything about the film, which, again, please don't ask me how this has been such a blind spot for so long. But I did finally watch it and I quite enjoyed the movie. It's only 68 minutes long. And I think that watching it kind of opened my eyes to how much comedy should probably revert back to the old days when films were as long as they needed to be and they were all jokes from top to bottom, as is the case with this movie, where literally every line, I mean, like, pretty much literally every line out of Groucho Marx's mouth is a joke or a pun or just something really mean and uncalled for. And it was just so nice to watch. I don't know why comedies can't be like that now. I don't know why we're having 140-minute auteurist epics from Judd Apatow now. I mean, I like Judd Apatow, but seriously. Even 21 Jump Street, which is great, is 110 minutes long.
Yeah. This Is 40 is a bad movie.
I have yet to see that, and I don't think we're going to be talking about it. So,
right.
Yeah.
When you watch something like Duck Soup, and it's, I don't think it's a perfect film, but it is extremely funny because it doesn't stop. It's just this propulsive beast of a comedy. And it's also surprising. It's very insightful too about the nature of war, which was a total surprise to myself. So yeah, if you haven't seen it like me, if you were a fool like myself, go watch it. It's on Netflix. Watch instantly. It'll take you 68 minutes. I mean, what else are we going to do with that time? We're going to dick around on the internet. Come on.
Jesus, you have such a contempt for people. It's incredible. Danny, what about yourself? What did you see that you think we should check out?
Well, I also watched quite a bit because I'm on winter break. The one I'll bring up, which was also kind of a blind spot, I guess, is Last Tango in Paris, which I'd never seen before.
Holy shit, I'm going to watch that tomorrow and make it my last film.
All right. Yeah, that's on Netflix too. Instant. Weird time.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one, Brian?
I have, yes.
Okay. And, you know, obviously it has a lot of baggage with it. I think the movie definitely lives up to its hype when it's just Marlon Brando and Maria Schneider just kind of in that room and just very about the...
Very appropriate.
Yeah.
Go, mm-hmm, before you...
yeah. So back to the comments. So, yeah, the movie... There's like this weird subplot kind of where Maria Schneider's character is also in a relationship with this filmmaker guy, and he's trying to film her in his movie. And that stuff felt a little flat to me and kind of forgettable, but everything else in the movie is really powerful. And I'd also, part of the fun of watching this movie was a lot of the reading I did afterwards, because there's a lot of good writing about it online. And I'd especially point you towards Pauline Kael's original review, which she wrote after seeing it at the New York Film Festival. And it's a pretty famous review where she kind of came out and said, like, this movie will change the face of the art form, and just a lot of hyperboles like that. And it's sort of a little bit depressing how that hasn't come true, because Last Tango in Paris was a movie that was rated NC-17, and it made almost like $100 million worldwide. And Bertolucci got nominated for a Best Director Oscar. And so, like, part of the movie is just thinking about how sad it is that that culture isn't really around anymore. But, yeah, it's still a good piece to check out if you've seen the film.
Well, you want me to use some butter?
Yeah, the butter.
And we're back to Nick's
that was my
terrible impression.
Was that a good Marlon Brando impersonation?
No.
The butter's actually not as... It's actually... The movie overall is more tame sexually than I.
It's more bread than butter. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, do you remember that butter scene? Like, it's really not.
No, it's not as bad as.
Yeah.
You know, movies, I mean, like that, they get built up and then you're like, oh, this is it. It's like when you read Catcher in the Rye for the first time.
Yeah. Most of the disturbing qualities of the movie is just like what's going on inside of Marlon Brando's head.
Indeed.
God
damn it, Nick.
I can't tell if that's a good impersonation or not.
That sounds exactly like your Christopher Walken impersonation.
Well,
which also sounds exactly like your Tom Hanks at the end of Cloud Atlas impersonation.
No.
Who just not. Like sound like a stroke victim every time you try to impersonate someone.
No, Tom Hanks at Cloud Atlas is never Thomas.
You're proving my point right now.
No, Tom Hanks and Clara says, "You're the child, you're a star."
Anyway, I'll give my thing, and then we can close out this debacle. Yeah, so as we know, I went to Houston this week, saw my parents. So most of my movie watching was seeing stuff with parents. And I saw like three different versions of The Christmas Carol, two of which are great, one of which not so much. I saw the god-awful live-action thing of The Grinch, which still like makes me feel like I have some sort of strange jungle like malady that's causing me to have weird fever dreams. That film is terrifying. I hate it. Every moment of that film is genuinely repulsive. Like, I almost want to have that be my thing just so I can talk about it, because I feel like I've been way too positive this podcast. But I haven't ever used A Few Good Men before, right?
Not that I can remember.
Okay, good. So A Few Good Men is a really good movie that I was watching with my parents. And yeah, it's. I mean, I feel like everyone knows it. You know, you can't handle the truth. If anyone doesn't have that speech memorized, they're not a friend of mine. Tom Cruise, Demi Moore.
What does Tom Hanks say in the movie? At the beginning and at the end.
I'll tell you, star.
I am a good man, clothed in immense power.
Is that your Daniel? Okay, if my impersonations are bad, then I don't know what that was.
Do you remember Danny's Christopher Walken impression? It was just him speaking.
That's generally what they're going to be like, yeah.
Oh, man. No, I mean, this is the film about Tom Cruise as a lawyer defending two Marines accused of murder, blah, 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 honor codes. It's really good. It's fantastic. It's Sorkin before he became aware that he was Sorkin. And yeah, it's a great film. I mean, like, it's just, you're going to sit down, you're going to watch it, you're going to love the hell out of it, and then it's going to be over and it won't have changed your life, but you will have enjoyed your time with it.
I've never seen that movie, unfortunately.
You should get on that, because it, like I said, yeah, it's good. It's not a game changer, you know, but it's good. I enjoy it. I also saw The Devil's Advocate.
I want to see that. That's one I haven't seen.
Oh God, it's so over the. If you like,
I've heard Pacino, it's like trashy and kind of crazy. Like,
yeah, it's completely nuts. And if you like Pacino when he's at his Pacino-iest, like,
oh, yeah,
the last like 30 minutes of this are for you, man.
All right, good.
So those are my two dual recommendations, because neither of them is that culturally significant. So I just have to make up for the intellectual weight by saying two of them. That being said, let's close it out for today. Like I said, in the upcoming week, since nothing is coming into theaters, we'll probably be talking about Les Mis, as well as giving you our top 10 films of 2012. And then as time goes on, we will catch up with Zero Dark Thirty, which will be hitting wide release on the 11th. And yeah, we'll figure out the rest as we go along. So gentlemen, let us say where we can be found on the internet, and then we can wish these fine people goodbye. Nick, start with you.
You can read me at thefilmstage.com, and you can follow me at twitter.com/Nick_Newman, where I'll tell you a story.
God damn it.
About butter. I'm so sorry.
You're going to be really disappointed with that scene. Like, I'm just telling you right now.
All right. I've been so excited.
He's been stocking up on butter for weeks. Danny, what about yourself?
And I have a Schneider in my house.
Jesus.
Also thefilmstage.com, as well as The Film Stage Show, this podcast,
really?
On iTunes. Also personal website, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And you can find me on my personal website at dearfilm.net. Again, this is The Film Stage Show, which you can find on iTunes. Give us a comment, give us a rating. Thank you, Danny. And you can find me at thefilmstage.com as well, and twitter.com/BrianJRoan, BrianJRoan. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and join us next week.
No, but I brought an extra bag.
We all appreciate what your wife was trying to do. Oh, my God.
I'm not pointing any fingers here.
Jesus. Okay. All right.